My name is Jane Barnett, so hello and welcome to today's South Pacific Weather Training Telecast Lecture. I'm delighted to welcome our speaker today, Dr. David Hammer, who's previously contributed to the Weather Teleclasses in 2008. He's also a member of our small organising committee for the South Pacific series here in New Zealand. And it's great that he's found time in what I know is a very busy schedule at the moment for many of us in infection prevention and control. So it's good to have him as our speaker today. David is currently a microbiology registrar at MedLab Laboratories in Christchurch. He trained in South Africa and has spent time working in the health service in the UK, during which time he completed the MRCP. He's a strong advocate for infection control, and as such, we're very pleased that he's chosen Christchurch as his place to live and work. Welcome, David, and thank you very much for agreeing to be one of our 2009 Weather Training Telecast speakers.
Thanks very much, Jane, and thanks for inviting me to talk on a subject which is quite close to my heart. Good afternoon, everybody. As Jane mentioned, my name is David Hammer. I'm currently a final year microbiology registrar, and I'd like to talk to you all this afternoon about Clostridium difficile, in particular O27, from a Southern Hemisphere perspective. I'd like to talk this afternoon about why I believe this is an important organism. I will be talking about the pathogenicity of this organism, and I'll be talking about the new strain which is sweeping across a lot of the world at the moment, which is, I think, cause for great concern. And then at the end, I will talk about infection control and treatment, and hopefully right at the end, there will be some time for questions, although I certainly don't pretend to have all the answers in what's a very dynamic field at the moment. So if we switch to the first slide, this is an article from one of our local newspapers from 2006. And you can see there are two shocking statements on this particular front page. The first of all is that the leotard is back in fashion. And the second shocking statement is that errors cost 30% of the health budget, which is quite a lot of health money going up in smoke. Now, to be fair, on reading this article, only a third of those errors were nosocomial infection. Other errors were surgical and drug errors. And if we look at the literature, only a third to a half of nosocomial infection is considered to be preventable. But it still works out to about 1/20th of our healthcare budget, which we're essentially wasting through preventable disease. So if you look at the next slide, you can't always trust what the lay media tell you. So I've had a look around some of peer review articles, and these are the figures I've come up with for the total annual cost estimated of nosocomial infection around the world. And you can see in the USA, the estimates are a little under $7 billion each year. The UK is estimated to spend £1 billion each year. And the estimate for New Zealand, and I believe this is just for acute care, is $136 million each year spent in infections acquired in healthcare facilities. Unfortunately, I couldn't find any recent articles relating to the cost of nosocomial infection in Australia. So if we move on to the next slide, Clostridium difficile is more than just a little diarrhea. Although it may not cause mortality, some case series and other studies have indicated a mortality rate of approximately 7%, and this goes up to about 64% when the complications of C. diff infection set in. The U.S. Recent estimates are that the U.S. spends $1 billion a year sorting out C. diff. The EU spends 300 million euros each year. And literature from the UK indicates that there's a £2,000 cost extra per case in the UK with an average increased length of stay of 10 days. And if you take into consideration that there were over 43,000 cases reported in the UK in 2004, and you do a bit of maths, you'll work out that something like £86 million was spent in the UK in 2004. So for the next slide, I have a vested interest which I should probably declare at this stage. an elderly family friend of mine a couple of years ago was admitted to a UK NHS trust for a routine shoulder operation. After the operation, he acquired C. diff and he unfortunately died in hospital, and it was a very undignified and painful death for him. And I have a personal interest in preventing further such tragedies through raising awareness of this particular disease. So in the next slide, we will have a look at the epidemiology. And it's quite interesting that about 50% of neonates in various studies have been found to carry Clostridium difficile. And this drops with time until less than 3% of two-year-olds. And from about the age of two, that figure remains about the same in healthy adults. So about 3% of the healthy adult population have C. diff present in their bowel. And these adults usually have fairly high antibody levels to toxin A, and you'll see the importance of this hopefully later on in this talk. In terms of people developing disease, it's believed mostly to be acquired from the environment, and a number of studies have indicated a lower incidence of the disease in single rooms versus double rooms. There are one or two recent studies also pointing to potential food sources where C. diff has been found in meat in some research that's been done. Person-to-person spread is very well documented, and in one study, 60% of healthcare workers' hands were found to be positive for C. diff, and that was in a subgroup of healthcare workers who were caring for people who had the disease or were carriers of the disease. Occasionally, infection can be endogenous, and sexual transmission has also been described. On the next slide, you'll see that it's not just patients who are potentially infected. There are a number of cases in the literature where healthcare workers have become infected, and these are usually people who've been working on the wards where there's C. diff present. And often they have been on antibiotics or have some other risk factor and then have come down with the Clostridium difficile. And there are one or two reports of laboratory workers being infected and developing disease after exposure to samples in the laboratory. And in the one report, they typed the strain that the person had been working with and the strain that they had, and they were identical. So the other way of asking this question on the next slide is, if we know why people get C. diff, why don't people get C. diff? And there are a number of factors which are protective. First of all, as I mentioned earlier, there is a percentage of the population who have their own antibodies to the toxin. And this means that they're protected to a large degree, even if they have the organism present. About 25% of the Clostridium difficile carried by people do not have the toxin gene present, so that they don't produce the toxin. And these organisms take up a niche in the bowel and don't allow the toxigenic strains to colonize the host. And so the non-toxigenic carriage is protective of developing disease. And the biggest protective factor is probably our own bowel flora. And per gram of stool, it's estimated that there are 10 to the 12 bacteria. And these use up all the nutrients that the Clostridium would like to use, and so the Clostridium never really gets a foothold. And this is referred to as bacterial interference, where one strain stops another strain from taking hold. It's probably worth noting at this stage that bowel flora does change with age. And so as one gets older, the numbers of the bacteria drop, and the species probably change as well, although there's a lot of research still outstanding in that field. Bowel flora can also be affected by antibiotics, by chemotherapy, or gastrointestinal surgery. And it's noteworthy that some of the first case reports of Clostridium difficile infection were from the time before antibiotics. And the first case report actually was a young woman who had had bowel surgery and then died of Clostridium difficile infection. As I mentioned earlier, about 50% of neonates are colonized with Clostridium difficile in some studies. But disease is very uncommon in neonates, and there's currently a bit of debate about the meaning of finding Clostridium difficile in the stools of children. The reason for the high colonization but low disease is probably that the neonates lack some sort of toxin receptor that becomes expressed as people grow up and become adults. So the toxin never gets a chance to work on young babies. On the next slide, I've just a brief bit about the organism. This is a gram-positive anaerobic bacillus, and it also has spores. And I've enclosed a picture, courtesy of the CDC, which shows the gram-positive rods, and you can see some of these subterminal spores, which are clearings within those gram-positive rods. So that's what it would look like on a gram stain if you grew a pure culture. Now, on the next slide, the Clostridium difficile has two pathogenicity factors which work in its favor and which enable it to cause disease in people. The first factor is that it develops spores, and this means that the organism wraps itself under a number of tough outer layers, which means it can survive unfavorable circumstances for quite some time, and then hatch out again when circumstances become more favorable and go about multiplying and causing disease. And the other pathogenicity factor is that the C. diff produces a number of toxins, and these cause absolute havoc on human tissue, and I'll tell you more about those in a few minutes. So the bacterial spore, as you can see on the next picture, basically the two central circles represent the dormant bacterial phase, and there are several outer layers, the germ cell wall, the cortex, the inner coat, outer coat, and exosporium, which protects the spore from heat, light, ultraviolet light, drying out, and various chemicals. And only when the environment returns to a favorable circumstance does the C. diff resume its normal business and hatch out from that spore. So on the next slide, there are a number of implications of spores. Spores can survive for months and possibly even decades in the environment. So once you've got a sporing organism in the environment, it's very difficult to get rid of it. And especially, it requires extreme measures to get rid of it, either using bleach or very high levels of heat, such as in an autoclave. Anything less than that will probably not eradicate the spores. And I've put a little diagram at the bottom just showing, starting with envelope viruses and vegetative bacteria, on a sort of ladder of eradication. So on the enveloped bacteria and vegetative enveloped viruses and vegetative bacteria, they're usually pretty easy to eradicate. But as you go up the ladder, you can see spores are quite close to the top, and they become they are very difficult to get rid of either from the patient or from the environment. The other pathogenicity factor is toxin production, and the disease that C. diff causes is actually toxin-based. It very rarely causes invasive disease. Almost all the disease is linked to the toxin that it produces, and there are three main toxins which have been identified. Toxin A is an enterotoxin, which causes some of the inflammatory response which we see in patients who are infected with C. diff. Toxin B is a cytotoxin, and it's thought to be 10 times more toxic than toxin A. And both of these toxins work on the cytoskeleton of the human cell, primarily the human colonic cell. And the binary toxin, which has recently been described, attacks actin filaments in the cell and causes cell death as well, although the workings of this binary toxin still have to be elucidated. On the next slide, I've got a diagram of the toxin genes. And the toxin A and toxin B are found on a gene segment called the chromosomal pathogenicity locus. And there are two other genes on that locus, TCDC and TCDD. And these act as regulatory genes. So the organism isn't producing toxin all the time. It's only when the genes, the regulatory genes are turned off that toxin is able to be produced by the cell. The binary toxin is not on the chromosomal pathogenicity locus and is controlled by other mechanisms. On the next slide, I have a diagram showing how the organism causes chronic disease. Coming in from the left side of the diagram, you can see the bacterium approaching the ciliated colonic cells and releasing toxins A and B, which then cause cytolysis and separation of the epithelium, and also induces a massive immune response, and you end up with a whole lot of cellular detritus, which is the hallmark of the C. diff infection on a macroscopic scale. we get pseudomembranous colitis. That's basically a whole lot of white cells and cellular debris which have clumped together to form that picture. Clinical manifestations usually occur within about 5 or 10 days of antibiotics having been started, although it's probably worth noting that two-thirds of patients who are found to have C. diff are actually asymptomatic. The clinical picture is usually one of a profuse watery diarrhea, which may or may not be bloody. About half the patients have fever and a raised white cell count, and about a third describe abdominal pains. Very rarely patients develop a bacteremia. There have been a couple of case reports of osteomyelitis and splenic abscess, and there are also a few isolated case reports of reactive arthritis following the disease. The complications are where the mortality really climbs to a significant level, and the two main complications are intestinal perforation, which can mimic an appendicitis, and toxic megacolon, which can look all the world like inflammatory bowel disease. And toxic megacolon, when it really gets going, has about a 64% mortality. Now, at this stage, I just want to put in a note to beware the known colitic patient. I'm aware of a gastrointestinal surgeon who is well regarded in his field, who had a colitic patient, a patient who had inflammatory bowel disease, come in sick. And he thought it was that the patient was suffering from the inflammatory bowel disease and did a colectomy, only to find that it was the C. diff which was causing the patient's symptoms, and the patient could have been treated with drugs instead of a colectomy. So in any patient with known inflammatory bowel disease who comes in with an exacerbation of their symptoms, it's worth checking for C. diff before doing any surgery. I'd like to talk about the diagnosis of Clostridium difficile. Clostridium difficile was described in the 1930s by Hall and O'Toole, who described it as a difficult bacterium because they struggled to grow it. It is quite a fussy little bug. However, it can be grown in the laboratory, and when it does grow, it forms non-hemolytic yellowy-white ground glass colonies with an uneven edge, which we refer to as having rhizoid margins. It has a pleasant horse manure-like odor, and if it's placed under ultraviolet light, it fluoresces chartreuse, which is a yellowy-green color named after the liqueur. It typically grows best on a special media called CCFA, which is cycloserine carfoxytin fructose agar, and this selects out the C. diff from all the other organisms in the bowel flora. However, this media is not particularly sensitive for spores unless bile salts are added to the media, and that encourages the spores to germinate. And it's also non-specific because the 25% of people who have non-toxigenic strains are also detected by this method. So on the next slide, the gold standard is culture and then neutralization of toxins. And this basically involves culture of the organism and then adding the organism colonies to cell culture with and without antibodies to the C. diff, and comparing whether or not the antibodies are protective of the cells in the cell culture. Although this is the gold standard, it's very slow, it takes several days to achieve, and it's also very expensive, so faster modalities have been developed. The one which is used by most centers is the enzyme-linked immunosorbent assay. This has a sensitivity ranging somewhere between 64% and 94% in comparison to the neutralization assay, but its specificity is pretty good at 75% to 100%. The earlier ELISAs only targeted toxin A, and that was a bit of a problem when strains which did not elaborate toxin A but had plenty of the potent toxin B were causing disease in patients, and the diagnosis was missed in the laboratory. So newer ELISAs almost all have the capability of detecting A and B. PCR has recently become available for direct diagnosis. It previously was only used for identification purposes from organisms which are grown on agar plates. and occasionally endoscopy is used to make the diagnosis. This is quite risky because you can imagine if the patient is at risk of perforating their bowel and then the bowel is sufflated with air in order to put the endoscope in, it can cause a perforation. But it can be very useful where you have patients who have inflammatory bowel disease and you need to know whether it's inflammatory bowel disease causing their symptoms or Clostridium difficile. So under special situations, it may have its place. So now I'd like to talk about the new outbreak strain. This goes by a number of names depending on how it's been identified. It's referred to as restriction endonuclease analysis B1 or pulse field gel electrophoresis NAP1, toxin type 3 or ribotype 027. Most of the literature seems to refer to it as ribotype 027. It was originally described in 1994, but historically was quite rare. When people have gone back and looked through stored isolates, it forms only about 5% of all the isolates of Clostridium difficile. In the past, it was sensitive to the various fluoroquinolones, particularly Gati and moxifloxacin, but the current epidemic isolate is resistant to all the fluoroquinolones, and that's probably what's given it the edge in its spread around the world. So in terms of pathogenesis, the 027 ribotype produces toxin A and toxin B and binary toxin. But one of the things which really makes it potent is that it has a deletion of the control gene, TCDC. And this means that toxins are produced earlier and at a higher level than normal strains, which makes it more virulent. And estimates vary, but a lot of the literature seems to suggest that it produces about 20 times the toxin compared to normal strains. It also appears to have increased sporulation ability. This may be linked to its toxin-producing activity. There are some papers which suggest that the mechanism by which these bacteria produce toxins are a control. So the mechanisms controlling toxin production also control for sporulation. And where you have sporulation, you have better environmental survival and therefore better spread through the environment. On the next slide, there are two graphs comparing the standard strains of C. diff, and in the yellow sigmoid curve, you can see the growth chart. And you can see that toxin production classically is produced late on when the organisms start to run out of food in their environment, and the toxin gene gets turned on to try and secure more food for the organism. This is in comparison to the 027 strains, where with the lack of the TCDC control, toxin production is turned on much earlier during the growth of the organism and therefore reaches much higher levels. So in the US, a new strain, well, this new 027 strain was identified in about 2001, and CDC data showed a rise of about 26% in discharge diagnosis of Clostridium difficile between 2000 and 2001. Canada had a major outbreak associated with high levels of mortality, and this was identified in 2002 to 2003. And what's worrying is that one of the factors which caused alarm and caused the epidemic to be picked up was that somebody suddenly asked why so many colectomies were being done. And one would hope that surveillance would be a bit better these days in picking up the fact that you've got a problem rather than waiting for increased number of colectomies. So Quebec went from 3.6 per 10,000 patient days in 1995 to an incidence in 2005 of more than 15 per 10,000 patient days. And in one study, the 027 variety caused death in 22 out of 132 cases compared to no deaths out of 25 patients infected with other strains. The UK has certainly had its fair share of this organism. And the incidence of Clostridium difficile-associated diarrhea, which now tends to be called Clostridium difficile infection, have doubled between 2001 and 2004. And there's a national incidence of 678 per 100,000 people over the age of 75. In 2004, there were 43,672 cases which were notified, and that was the year that notification became mandatory. So part of the doubling effect from 2001 and 2004 was a reporting bias, but certainly 43,000 cases is quite a lot of people affected. This organism has continued to spread throughout the EU. In 2005, it was reported in the Netherlands. 2006, Austria, Denmark, France, Switzerland, and Scotland all reported it. 2007, Belgium, Germany, Ireland, Norway, Spain, and Japan all found the organism. And in 2008, Sweden had its first isolation of the organism. A lot of the initial cases had links back to UK hospitals. There were either patients or staff linking back to UK hospitals. So the New Zealand and Oceania situation currently is that presently Clostridium difficile doesn't appear to be a major problem in our patients, although it is present. There doesn't seem to be a major epidemic, but it's not currently a notifiable disease. There's no coordinated screening program, and I have written on that slide that there's no O27 specific surveillance, but breaking news is that there's currently a New Zealand-wide survey going on where a whole lot of laboratories are collaborating to look for this particular organism to get an idea of what our current prevalence is. Australia has also been running a similar survey, and I believe they've found one organism so far, which caused a lot of excitement. It's really only just a matter of time before this organism arrives, and I'm not entirely convinced that we're ready for it. In terms of the treatment, stopping the offending antibiotic is sufficient to cure about 20% of patients who have C. diff infection. Giving supportive therapy such as fluids and electrolytes is also important. And it's also important not to give the patient antiperistaltic agents, as this traps the toxin in the bowel where it can carry on doing its work and makes the disease a whole lot worse. And current recommendations are not to treat asymptomatic carriers. There are two main treatments recommended for C. diff at present. The first one is metronidazole, which is primarily given orally. This is a cheap antibiotic, and it's recommended for first-line use in mild disease. Where patients are not able to take anything by mouth, there is some evidence to show that intravenous metronidazole has some efficacy, but in the first instance, oral metronidazole should be given. The other therapy which is commonly used is vancomycin. This is a very expensive drug, and it's therefore recommended for use in first line in patients with severe disease. Now, the definitions of severe disease do vary a bit, but the ones which seem to be common are having a white cell count greater than 20, a creatinine greater than 200, old age, so greater than 70 years, and or CT evidence of inflammation of the bowel. And the recommendation is to use it second line in mild disease. So on the next slide, both metronidazole and vancomycin have about a 90% cure rate and about a 15% relapse rate. There is some in vitro resistance described, and that's in the ballpark of about 3% of strains which have been tested in the lab. But the significance of this is not entirely understood. And there is a bit of concern about increasing incidence of vancomycin resistance enterococci with the use of vancomycin. And there have been a couple of papers recently suggesting that VRE may be associated with the use of metronidazole as well, but that's currently a source of debate. There are a whole number of other treatments which have been tried with varying success. Various other antibiotics, such as teicoplanin, the rifamycins, either rifampicin or a new drug called rifamixin, fusidic acid, bacitracin, and nitazoxanide. These have all been tried, and there have been some success, but the success hasn't quite matched the metronidazole or vancomycin, and therefore these are not recommended first line. A number of people have tried anion exchange resins, and the theory behind that is that the resin will bind the toxin and therefore reduce its effect on the bowel wall. And again, this has been successful in some patients, but certainly not all. the trouble with using anion exchange resins is they tend to bind to the antibiotic which you're trying to treat the C. diff with, reducing the efficacy of the antibiotic. There have been a couple of case reports using intravenous immunoglobulins, and these have usually been used in patients who have had multiple relapses or are severely ill with the disease. This is a very, very expensive therapy. And the theory behind it is, as I mentioned, about 3% of people have the organism but no disease because they have their own antibodies to the disease. So by giving patients with C. diff disease antibodies to the toxin, it's thought that it can give the bowel a chance to recover. And it's not widely used, but there have been a number of successful case reports. And lastly, when things become really desperate, there have been a number of successful case reports where donor stool has been administered to desperately ill patients with very good outcomes. Usually this is given by a nasogastric tube to replace the bacteria which have been lost through antibiotics or chemotherapy and outcompete the C. diff that's there. On the next slide, recurrence has been well described, and then recurrence may be multiple, and it seems that with each recurrence a patient has, there's an increased chance of having a further recurrence. Up to about 50% of recurrences have been found to be a different strain, so it's not necessarily that the patient's C. diff has developed resistance to the treatment that's been given. It may just be that they've picked up C. diff again from the environment. So the advice is to retreat the C. diff with the initial antibiotic that was used. Recurrence also may be a result of spores in the bowel germinating. And for that reason, a number of people have tried either tapering or pulsed doses of vancomycin to eradicate the bacteria as they germinate from their spores. And this can be successful in patients with multiple recurrences. A number of authors have suggested the use of probiotics, but the role of probiotics is certainly not proven at this stage. The two organisms which have shown the most promise are Saccharomyces boulardii and Clostridium coccoides. There is, however, a risk of causing nosocomial disease with these organisms if the patient is immune compromised, so it's certainly not without its risks. I'd now like to talk about prevention and control of C. diff, and standard precautions are always important. In terms of case management, putting the patient into contact or enteric isolation goes a long way to reducing the spread, and ideally the patient should have their own toilet. Gloves should be worn when dealing with the patient, and gowns should also be worn, especially if dealing with soiled material from the patient. Hand hygiene is also important. And good hand washing is really a keystone in preventing the spread of C. diff. Washing is currently the preferred method of hand hygiene when you're dealing with Clostridium difficile infection, and that's because alcohol doesn't kill the spores. However, having said that, at present there are no studies to show that units which have gone across to mostly alcohol-based hand disinfection there's no link between that and increased infections, but that remains to be seen whether or not that changes. Environmental factors are very important. Having good bed-to-toilet ratios definitely reduces the spread of the disease. Environmental disinfection is vital. There have been a couple of studies which have shown that where there's inadequate cleaning, the spores just persist. And more spores from newer patients also arrive in the environment. A number of cleaning agents have been shown to be effective in the literature, and these include hyperchlorites, peracetic acid, and peroxides, although currently the CDC recommends only hyperchlorites for eradication of spores. And it's really important that the cleaning staff understand how important their job is, because an adequate cleaning job is really necessary to eradicate C. diff from the environment. There are a couple of papers which recommend using ultraviolet markers to make sure that the cleaning is adequate. There was a further paper where the researchers went in and swabbed rooms that had been terminally cleaned and found spores, and then cleaned the room again using proper technique, and the spore count dropped significantly. And when this information was fed back to the cleaners then took it upon themselves to ensure that the cleaning job was done thoroughly, and the Clostridium difficile detection rate went down after the cleaners had done their job. Cleaners really are a vital component of the healthcare nosocomial infection prevention, and it's really worth them knowing how important their job is. Cleaning of non-isolation areas is also important. There have been a couple of papers which have shown that even when patients in isolation, C. diff can be detected on the ward outside of the isolation areas. There's also a potential for increased sporulation when either non-sporicidal agents are used, such as detergents, or very diluted concentrations of sporicides are used. So by using the wrong agent to clean your environment with, you can actually encourage the organism to form spores and persist for longer. There are a number of disinfectant vaporizers being tested, either using hypochlorites or peroxides, although they show some promise, the jury is out on that at the moment. And there are some authors who have highlighted the fact that cleaning of bedpans is a potential problem in stopping cross-infection, because the average bedpan cleaner disinfector only reaches a temperature of about 80 degrees, which is not adequate to kill the spores. So where there are outbreaks, it may be worth looking at how the bedpans are being cleaned. On the next slide, there are a number of new products coming out onto the market, which make all sorts of claims of being very efficient against killing Clostridium difficile. And these studies, which are used to justify these claims, are really based on the vegetative form of the bacteria, not the spore form. And this was highlighted at a recent conference at the Society of Healthcare Epidemiology of America by Professor John Boyce. And I think the same caution needs to be applied when looking at your supplies of disinfectants, because there are a number of new disinfectants coming onto the market, many of which claim to have great effect against C. diff, but may be testing against the vegetative rather than the spore form. There are a couple of interesting studies which suggest that we should be identifying our high-risk patients and making sure that they're protected against C. diff. So that goes somewhat against using standard precautions in a way, but it's certainly an interesting idea when healthcare systems which are running on tight budgets. The risk factors for patients are age, having multiple comorbidities, being on antibiotics, and there's some evidence to suggest that being on proton pump inhibitors or other gastric acid suppressants may be a risk factor. And there's a recent paper in the Journal of Hospital Infection which suggests that patients with a Waterlow score of greater than 20 are at potential risk of developing C. diff during their hospital stay, and this was estimated to have a sensitivity of 70% and a specificity of 95%. So certainly worth considering looking out for who your patients are at highest risk, and really making every effort that you can to make sure that they're not infected during their stay. On the next page, patient hygiene may also be a factor. There are one or two papers which show that Clostridium difficile carriage continues on the skin of patients who have either been infected and recovered or are currently symptomatic. And this raises an interesting question about how well patients are cleaned in healthcare facilities, although that probably is a bit opening something of a can of worms. The other arm of infection control is rationalizing antibiotic use. Clostridium difficile is often associated with antibiotic use, and outbreaks have been associated with various antibiotics. The first outbreaks coincided with the introduction of clindamycin, and then as cephalosporins were introduced onto the market, we tended to see more outbreaks occurring. And finally, with fluoroquinolones being used all over the place, we've seen a huge increase in C. diff. Now, it's generally believed that about 50% of antibiotics used are unnecessary, So if we can reduce the number of unnecessary antibiotics, we could go a long way to reducing the risk of our patients developing C. diff. And there are some studies which show that Clostridium difficile infection rates improve if your antibiotic stewardship is improved. So it's something certainly to consider, not just having good infection control, but having good antibiotic use policies. Let's see. On the next slide, the Society for Healthcare Epidemiology of America, in combination with the Infectious Disease Society of America, have issued guidelines, and these are available on the website, which I've listed there. And this is in recognition of the fact that C. diff is causing such a problem around the world. And although there are quite a number of articles in the guideline, the main things come down to contact precaution, good environmental cleaning, good hand hygiene, an effective laboratory-based notification system, active surveillance of Clostridium difficile infection rates, and education of all levels of healthcare, so from clinicians to management to patients and visitors. And having management buy-in into these programs is really, really important. And finally, they also list antimicrobial stewardship as being an important factor. Under experimental work, there are journal articles coming out every week on Clostridium difficile at the moment. There is currently a vaccine under development, and the theory behind that is that if you have your own antibodies to the toxin, your bowel is protected against the effects of the toxin. But unfortunately, at the moment, that's still experimental, but may become available in years to come. So in conclusion, the message of infection control remains the same. That's that we need to make sure that our hand washing is adequate. And so finally, I'd like to thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, David. That's excellent. I think I might use that quote myself that you put in your final slide. That could be handy. I think that those of us who've worked in the UK at any point will have a different experience of C. diff. So it's really good to hear that, that there's some increasing surveillance going to be put in place in the Southern Hemisphere so that we can monitor things maybe a bit more closely. In my experience, certainly there's been a general underestimation, I think, of the potential impact of C. diff in our hospitals. And until we see this pathogenic strain, then we may not realise quite the extent of that risk. Just a quick question for you from me. What about children? You mentioned children in one of your earlier slides as probably having certainly positive stools. Is there a place for testing in children of certain ages or conditions?
That certainly is an interesting question. There's a lot of debate in the literature about this. Certainly in older children with bowel symptoms, it may be worth considering. In younger children and certainly asymptomatic children, the indications for testing is markedly reduced. I don't think there is actually an answer for that at this point in time, but that's something which is being debated in the journals at present.
Okay, thanks for that. We'll watch and wait on that one then. I'd like to take this opportunity to say a big thank you once again for your contribution to this year's teleclass, both as a speaker and organiser. It's very much appreciated. I think you provided us with a really good insight into C. diff disease and the implications for our patients, and certainly with that local flavour as well. That's been really useful.
Oh, thank you. That's been my pleasure, Dan.
Thank you. For those of you listening in, please don't forget that you can access any of the other weather telecasts by registering via the website and either listening to them live or via the rebroadcast or recording. From all of us here in Christchurch, many thanks for joining us, and we'll look forward to speaking to you again soon. Goodbye for now.